I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be talking about something that happens every year. And for that conversation, I'm joined by someone I hope to have with us every year. We certainly did last year. Professor Josh Dunn is going to be here talking about the Supreme Court's most recent term. It has been a significant term on a number of areas of Supreme Court decision making, jurisprudence, and constitutional interpretation. And who better to have us with us today than Josh Dunn? He is Executive Director of the Institute of American Civics at the Howard Baker School for Public Policy and Public Affairs at the University of Tennessee. He is a teacher of the U.S. Constitution and the Supreme Court, an avid follower of the Supreme Court. He's an author. He's been published in, well, everywhere. The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, LA Times, but also has written some terrific scholarly books on the court and on the federal judiciary. One couple I want to recommend to our listeners that you should pick up if you haven't read them already. One's called Complex Justice, The Case of Missouri v. Jenkins, and another is From Schoolhouse to Courthouse, The Judiciary's Role in American Education. And I would be remiss if I also didn't highlight Josh's wonderful volume that he has put together for Ashbrook, our core document series on the judiciary. I teach Supreme Court and judiciary, and I use Josh's volume. I basically rip off everything from Josh. Thanks for joining us today, Josh.
It's great to be with you. Yeah. So thanks, Jeff.
This term, there were certainly some headline cases. And our listeners, as you know, are pretty historically informed and sort of follow contemporary public affairs. But I always like to start with those headliners. What stuck out to you as some of the more important headline decisions of the court this term?
Wow. So I'll start with actually a trilogy of cases that were all authored by three justices who are normally considered to be on the liberal wing of the court, because I think they point to some important shifts on the court. And they all came out the same week, if I recall, maybe even the same day. But there was a case, Ames versus Ohio Department of Youth Services. So for those folks like you guys in Ohio, then there's Smith and Wesson Brands versus Estados Unidos Mexicanos, and then Catholic Charities Bureau versus Wisconsin Labor and Industry Review Commission. And what was significant, I think, about those cases was not necessarily the outcome, because I think if you looked at the issues in those cases, you knew where how the court was going to vote. What was significant was the fact that you had the opinions assigned to the liberal block of justices to write the majority opinions. They showed you some significant changes in constitutional law. I'm just not certain that you see those same justices. They weren't on the court 20, 25 years ago, but I don't think that they're writing the majority opinion or joining the majority in these cases. So, for instance, the Ames decision out of Ohio is written by Justice Jackson. And that was about whether or not someone from a majority group who doesn't have some identifying characteristic that makes them a minority has to have a higher evidentiary standard in claims of discrimination. And Justice Jackson, unanimous court, said that no, that Title VII of the Civil Rights Act does not require a higher evidentiary standard. And there are many lower courts that had required that. And I'm not certain that 20, 25 years ago, you get such unanimity on the court, or you get someone like Justice Jackson writing the majority opinion. The Smith and Wesson case, that was a case where Mexico had brought a lawsuit against U.S. gun manufacturers, and the court ruled in favor of the gun manufacturers, particularly Smith and Wesson. And they said that Mexico could not even plausibly allege that the manufacturers had aided and abetted gun dealers' unlawful sales of firearms to traffickers in Mexico. And again, I'm not certain that I think you're going to get the same decision. But Kagan writing the decision for the majority was significant. And then maybe the most interesting case was the Catholic Charities case. And that was, the majority opinion there was written by Justice Sotomayor. And that was what had happened in Wisconsin was the state of Wisconsin had said that Catholic Charities had to pay an unemployment tax, even though that they were a religious organization, because they said that the services that Catholic Charities was performing were not religious in nature. And normally they would allow a religious organization to not have to pay this this unemployment tax or pay into this unemployment insurance pool. And the Supreme Court, again, written with a majority decision written by Justice Sotomayor, said that actually entangles the government into questions of theology for religious organizations, that it's not appropriate. Where, you know, Catholic Charities says we engage in charitable work and we don't engage in proselytization because we think as part of our doctrine, we're just required to engage in charitable work and not do the proselytization there, but it's part of our theology. It's part of our doctrine. And so I think that was a pretty significant case as well. So I think those are three interesting ones to start off with.
Well, let's take that last one. That's particularly interesting to me, the Catholic Charities case, as you say, written by Justice Sotomayor, perhaps the most liberal member of the court. And it seems to be, and maybe you can correct me on this, but to me at least, it seems like it's another in the string of religious liberty victories that have happened over the course of a number of years now. Maybe it's five, maybe it's 10 years, but there seems to be, and maybe this was an Establishment Clause case, maybe this was a free exercise case, but it does seem like there are increasing victories on that front.
Oh yeah, I think that you can go back maybe 12, 14 years and start to see the shift. And in some ways it's a shift from the Establishment Clause to the Free Exercise Clause. For a long time, most of the action was under the Establishment Clause, but really in the last 12 to 14 years, the Free Exercise Clause has received far more attention, and there have been far more cases revolving around religious liberty and therefore the Free Exercise Clause. And you saw that with the ministerial exception rule. That's maybe where it kind of got started. Then you had that trilogy of cases involving the Blaine Amendment or laws that had the effects of Blaine Amendments, where the states were not allowed to provide any funding that would go to any religious entities. And so there's Trinity Lutheran versus Combe, or Espinoza versus Montana, Carson versus Macon. And so you're right. This is in a line of cases where you've seen the expansion of religious liberties by the court. And again, the fact that Sotomayor wrote the majority opinion is, I think, significant in its own right. You don't see someone who is where she is on the court 25 years ago writing an opinion like this, I think.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. So interesting, Justice Jackson, Justice Kagan, and Justice Sotomayor, those three justices you mentioned writing those decisions. Are you saying that it's surprising you wouldn't have seen this 25 years ago because the court's doctrine on these issues had not developed that far, or because we've seen a shift in the court such that what was once what is now a liberal, considered a liberal member of the court 25 years ago would have been someone in the center? Has the court shifted, or has the court's doctrine changed?
I think it's both. I think it's both. And it shows you the influence of the doctrine in affecting, I think, the judicial philosophy of the liberal members of the court. Yeah, we know from Justice Kagan, for instance, that she was highly influenced by Scalia. She talked about his influence in shaping, particularly, say, in statutory interpretation. But you can see it really decidedly with her. And I think that part of it is that on some of these issues, the conservative bloc of the court, at least in some cases, has persuaded the liberal bloc of the court that this line of doctrine is correct.
And including someone like Justice Jackson on that Title VII case, is that right?
Yes, yes, yeah. So that's one where, go back to the 1970s. You think about who was kind of the intellectual leader of the liberal wing of the court in the 1970s. It was William Brennan. I can't imagine, right, William Brennan accepting Justice Jackson's reasoning in the Title VII case.
Fascinating. So it, does it mean, I'm ask another question about sort of judicial philosophy. There's that phrase ostensibly uttered by a famous law professor. Well, we're all originalists now. Does it mean that when you say the court's philosophy is moving, does it mean that there is an increasing embrace of originalism or of textualism, or is it something else? What's happening on the court?
So I think a couple of things. Some, it's the originalism. And even, although I don't think that there's a majority of originalists, or at least pure originalists on the court, even among the conservatives, there's Gorsuch is a committed originalist. I think Barrett is, Thomas is. But Alito and Kavanaugh and Roberts, I don't know that you could accurately describe them as originalists. They are very deeply informed by originalism, and it certainly influences their decision making. But I'm not certain that it's decisive for them. However, it exercises a significant influence on them, and it has exercised a significant influence on the liberal bloc on the court. Yeah. So Justice Kagan, during her hearings, Supreme Court hearings when she was nominated, she actually said, in some ways, we're all originalists now. That was one of the people who said this. And she also cited Scalia in shaping her approach to statutory interpretation, which is a much more textualist approach. So it's that. But it's also, I think, that there could be some things going on where they also recognize if they want to have some influence on the court, they might have to maybe moderate their positions in order to make common cause with a more conservative wing of the court.
Hmm. Now, of course, there have been cases that decisions this year where there was a 6-3 so-called conservative, so-called liberal split. We still have seen that to some extent.
Oh, yes. It's obviously still there. The case that has received the most attention, I don't know that it will have nearly as much effect as people think it will have, or the effect might not match the amount of attention that it's received. And that was just from the last day of the court's term. And that was the birthright citizenship case, which wasn't really about birthright citizenship, but more really about universal injunctions or nationwide injunctions, the Trump versus Casa decision. And there we saw the standard 6-3 conservative liberal split.
Tell us a little bit about that case, because it was in the headlines a lot. But as you're suggesting, and the media made it seem like it's a victory for President Trump's policies, and he can go forward with this now, and courts are out of the way. Is that an accurate reading, or is it a little bit more complex?
It's much more complex than that. So I think, the person who's written the most on these universal injunction is very, very critical of them as a fellow named Samuel Bray. He teaches at Notre Dame. He's actually moving to the University of Chicago Law School. His reaction to the decision is, look, this executive order, which prompted the injunction, which then the court used to address the entire issue of universal injunctions, said he thinks that executive order is never going to go into effect. That's just his sense of it. Because there are other ways that it's going to be slowed. The court itself said that the executive order can't go into effect for at least a month, so that the parties involved can bring their other claims and start litigating those. So there are opportunities, for instance, for plaintiffs to create class actions. And it's a little more cumbersome to create a class action. And sometimes trial courts don't like going through that more burdensome process, but you can always use the vehicle of a class action to assemble everyone who is in the same situation. It's the language is all similarly situated people. So that's a possibility. And also, the court will probably be a little more aggressive in actually fast tracking some of these cases as well. What we've seen is a rise in the number of cases and the court's emergency docket, so-called emergency docket. And those are just cases where the court doesn't receive full briefings on them and maybe full argumentation. I think it was Kavanaugh who, in his concurring opinion, basically said the court will just have to do its job more and potentially a little more quickly. So I think that the odds are that, that executive order changing the understanding of citizenship, and rejecting the understanding that, has traditionally been attributed to the 14th Amendment. There's a very good chance, as Professor Bray has said, that it will not go into effect. Mm. Now, the other issue is that, both sides have done this venue shopping or forum shopping, where if you have a Democratic president, you will have conservatives. They'll identify a district court where they can file a case in, where they know there's a good likelihood that they're going to get a judge who's very sympathetic to them. And you have one district court judge who will issue an injunction for the entire country. You even had Justice Kagan back in 2022. She said at a public event that it just cannot be right that there one district court judge somewhere in America can shut down a policy for the entire country. It's fascinating that she didn't join the majority opinion here. I suspect it has more to do with the fact that it was the Trump administration and the particular issue of birthright citizenship behind it. But you've even had other justices on the court from the more liberal bloc express exasperation with this venue and forum shopping and recognizing that something has to be done about it.
So for our listeners who have, again, historically minded and thinking about the historical place and authority of courts, of federal courts in the system, am I right to say here what the court held is that district courts can issue injunctions, which is stopping a certain action, but they can't issue a universal injunction, meaning one that's for the whole country. It can be for the case in front of them. They right. can stop action so that the parties can litigate properly and get the issues in front. So they still have that power. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yes. So it's only the people who are party to the case. The Supreme Court in the majority decision, Barrett did hold out that there might be some conceivable issues that by their very nature would require a universal injunction that you couldn't actually cabinet to the particular parties in front of you. But it's clear that the court thinks that that's going to be something quite rare, and that district court judges are going to have to confine themselves to the actual plaintiffs who are involved in the case. In most circumstances.
And I think these kind of universal injunctions, are they relatively new in the course of the American judicial history?
Yes, they are very new. You just didn't see them for most of American history. They've really increased just in the past 20 years or so. And that was a lot of Barrett's opinion was focused on the history behind this and said, is this actually a power that had been given to the court or in the lower courts? So looking at, for instance, the Judiciary Act of 1789, did they expect lower courts to have this kind of authority, trial courts to have this kind of authority? Is there anything in the history of equity? Injunctions are tools that come out of equity for courts. And so their survey of the historical record just shows that this was not expected, nor was it a common practice. And the courts in the country had managed to get by just fine without it, for the vast majority of our history.
Before we continue with our conversation, I think it's important to take a moment and tell you about our undergraduate honors program in the liberal arts here at Ashland University.
Hi, I'm Rich Police, Associate Director of Student Programs at the Ashbrook Center. The Ashbrook Scholar Program is an honors program located at Ashland University for undergraduate students with an interest in politics, history, and economics. Modeled after a classical liberal education, you will read the great texts, not textbooks. Your classes will be conversations, not lectures. Conversations with other students, with your professors, and with great thinkers and statesmen from throughout human history. If you or a young person you know are passionate about life's important questions, if you want an education that emphasizes discovery, if you value liberal education and the principles of freedom it upholds, then this is the place for you. To learn more, visit us online at ashbrookscholar.org.
So as you say, there were a number of, including this case, a number of important decisions on sort of the judicial power itself this term. There were also some decisions that I might call, and certainly commentators have called, decisions on social issues. What kind of social issue cases did the court take up this term?
All right. So I think there are two really significant ones. I'll give you at least, three. Probably the one that got the most initial attention was U.S. versus Scrimeti, and that emerged from here in Tennessee. And that involved the ban from the state legislature on treatment for transgender youth prior to the age of 18. No hormone treatment, those things forbid it for minors. And there was a challenge saying that it violated the Equal Protection Clause, that it was a sex-based classification and therefore should receive heightened scrutiny. And it went to the Supreme Court, and Chief Justice Roberts, writing for the majority in the court, said, no, this law satisfies, it does not violate the Constitution. And they really only needed to apply rational basis review to it because it was not a sex-based classification. It was a medical classification, and the fact that sex was involved was incidental to it. And of course, there were dissenters in the case who disagreed with that. But that was a significant social issues case. Then you have one, Mahmoud versus Taylor, and that involved a case out of Montgomery County, Maryland, where the Montgomery County School Board had mandated an inclusive reading curriculum for kindergarten and elementary school students, where students were required to listen to or read books on issues such as transgenderism or pride parades or gay marriage. There were a number of parents, a kind of coalition of Muslim, Jewish, and Christian parents who were opposed to this. For a while, the school district had allowed opt-outs for this, but the volume was significant. There were many parents, I'm certain, who didn't have religious motivations, who thought that it was just simply inappropriate for the age of the students. But the school board got rid of the opt-out program. And so this coalition of religious parents sued, claiming it violated their free exercise rights to control the religious upbringing of their children. And the Supreme Court agreed, six to three decision, written by Alito, applying Wisconsin versus Yoder. That was a famous free exercise case that exempted the Amish from mandatory schooling after grade eight. And the lower courts had actually said, well, Yoder doesn't really apply. It only applied. It was a unique decision that only applied to the Amish because of their particular circumstances. And kind of reading into it, it's almost like, well, the lower courts were saying that Yoder didn't apply to anyone else, or it could only apply to religions that could be like quaint tourist attractions or something like that. And the majority on this, Alito just was not going to, he said, no, Yoder announces a principle of general application. He also said, and I think this was significant, he said that, well, the school board's, one of their defenses was, well, the state still allows you to send your child to private school if you want. And he said, that's no defense at all. That is really no defense at all, partly because the state does not actually support sending children to private school in Maryland. They don't have education savings accounts or vouchers. Parents have to do it at all at their own expense. So you can't say, in our graciousness, we allow you to send your kid to private school. So therefore, you have to accept this policy. This is a case that I'm certain is going to lead to much more litigation. And then a final case, Free Speech Coalition versus Paxton. This is where Texas law had required that websites that had at least 33% of their content that was harmful to minors. Another phrase that comes up in the case is obscene for minors. So you have the normal definition of obscenity, and then there's a stricter definition of obscenity for minors, the court said. And so they had to do age verification. The websites had to have policies so they could verify the ages of the people accessing their content. And the Supreme Court upheld that. Again, it kind of hinged on what standard of review the court should apply. The majority said it's only intermediate scrutiny. You don't have to get to strict scrutiny with it, where the dissenters said there should be strict scrutiny with this. And they said, the dissenters said, we agree that there's a compelling government interest to keep this material out of the eyes of minors, but perhaps they didn't use the least restrictive means possible. And that's what you have to do in order to satisfy strict scrutiny. But the majority said, no, we just, intermediate scrutiny is fine. It easily satisfies the requirements of intermediate scrutiny.
Mm. So it seems like, I'm thinking about the Mahmoud case, for example, that you mentioned as one of those three. It's the 100th anniversary of Pierce versus Society of Sisters,
yes,
case out of Oregon. Yeah. I'm wondering about the status today, and a lot of our listeners will be interested in this question, of the status of parents' rights in education. The Mahmoud case seems to suggest that parents have the right in directing the education of their children to opt out of things that of curriculum and activities at public schools that they feel are wrong or offensive to their children. Is that the right reading of that? Is that where we stand with parents' rights in education today?
It certainly is. And I think that the case is going to lead to even a greater expansion of that. And I'm glad you brought up Pierce versus Society of Sisters, because Justice Alito cited that in the majority opinion. The Supreme Court famously said in Pierce that the child is not a mere creature of the state. And Justice Alito said that was not a free exercise decision, but it still supports what we are doing here. And so there's this kind of combination of parental rights under Pierce plus under the free exercise clause that is, I think, going to lead to an expansion of parental authority to opt their children out of instruction or issues or materials that they regard as inappropriate in light of their religious beliefs. Hmm.
Those are obviously, you mentioned a number of really important marquee cases, headline cases that are going to have significant impact as the court, as you know, in further litigation, changing public policy, changing the law in a number of ways, or upholding the law and leading to probably more state laws on various issues. What about a case for our listeners who are, you know, they're not a court, all of us are not this careful court watcher that you are, and scholar. Was there a case or cases out there that you thought, now here's a case that maybe flew under the radar a little bit, and maybe it was one of those that you mentioned first, but that is really going to be important or could be important in the long run that just didn't get the kind of press that it might otherwise deserve?
So there's a case that also came out of the court's shadow docket or emergency docket, Trump versus Wilcox. And in that case,
I have to confess, I have not heard of this case.
So that was a case where they issued a 6-3 decision that stayed the blocking of reinstatement of NLRB and MSPB. So the National Labor Relations Board and Merit System Protection Board members who were fired by Trump. And the issue there is the constitutional status of independent regulatory agencies.
Whoa, that's big.
And so this is basically, in that decision, the court was signaling, I think, that Humphrey's executor is not long for this world. So Humphrey's executor.
For our listeners, yeah. What's Humphrey's executor?
So Humphrey's executor is a case during the FDR administration involving the firing of a member of a independent regulatory commission and its executor, because the man had died by the time it reached the issue had reached the Supreme Court. Interestingly, of course, Roosevelt wanted the authority to fire members of independent regulatory commissions, but Congress had created these commissions and they had insulated the members of them from direct political control by the president. They serve for fixed terms. And then they can only be fired under very narrow circumstances. And so you just can't fire them because you disagree with their policy positions, for instance.
For our listeners, these are independent agencies in the executive branch.
Yes, kind of. That's the issue.
Kind of. Yeah,
so
okay.
They're kind of in the. Okay. Well, that's what. So what the court said is that, well, Congress was creating these quasi-legislative and quasi-executive agencies. And therefore, it's legitimate for Congress to give them this kind of political insulation, but they are, yeah, under the executive branch, but not directly under the immediate control of the executive. So that's the issue with them. And so with that decision, you know, Trump has fired many members of these commissions. I think the conservatives in particular have viewed Humphrey's executor as a mistake for a long time. And this is going to be their opportunity to overturn Humphrey's executor. I mean, you can go back to, Justice Scalia was probably the person most associated with arguing that these independent regulatory commissions cannot be reconciled with the Constitution itself, with its structure or logic or language. And so that's going to be coming. They have not officially overturned Humphrey's executor yet, but it's likely going to happen given what they did in that case.
Well, isn't that interesting? So what started with FDR, a liberal Democrat, being continued on now in this era by conservatives?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one, you know, Roosevelt, he was not happy about this decision. And so it's kind of fascinating that the left has been the biggest defender of Humphrey's executor for several decades now.
It is interesting to me that you mentioned that some of these cases were unanimous, 9-0, surprising, perhaps written in surprising ways. Then we have some of what you probably consider the more traditional 6-3 split. And then some cases where, of course, you can never really predict where the justices are going to fall on certain cases, or at least what the split will be. The courts have taken a lot of heat, at least since President Trump came into office. And obviously, the CASA case, you know, is a clipping of the wings of the federal district courts. What's your sense now that we've had some stability in membership on the court? Justice Jackson is on the court and been on now for terms. What's your sense of the way that the Supreme Court is functioning?
Yeah, so you obviously have some clear divisions. If you were to categorize the court into blocks, you have, of course, the liberal block of Kagan, Sotomayor, and Jackson. The most reliable conservative block would be Gorsuch, Alito, and Thomas. So, for instance, there was a case also, I think, announced just this on the last day of the court's term involving the non-delegation doctrine, and that block dissented, and there was a dissenting opinion written by Justice Gorsuch. But you had the other members of the conservative bloc joining the liberal members of the court, so Roberts, Barrett, and Kavanaugh, essentially not, you know, expanding or resuscitating this non-delegation doctrine. The non-delegation doctrine is essentially the idea that the legislative branch cannot delegate legislative authority to another entity, can't do it to the executive branch or to the an agency. And that the case that was involved there was called FCC versus Consumers Research. FCC versus Consumers Research. And Kagan offered the majority principle, and she said there was sufficient guided discretion, that there was not a constitutional problem, and that the FCC had articulated what she called an intelligible principle that made it satisfactory. So that's it. That's an area where you do see some divisions that you might not expect if you don't pay really close attention to the court, because the non-delegation doctrine is something that many conservatives had in their sights for a while. And then you see this other block kind of, you could, to the extent that you can say that there's a middle block on the court, it would be Roberts and Barrett and Kavanaugh. Some people think that Roberts is the median vote on the court, or maybe Barrett is, but they seem to be maybe a swing block. So I think you do see them operating, along those lines of division. I will say, if we want to go back to Trump versus CASA, one of the more surprising things in the majority's decision, Justice Barrett's opinion, was the very, very pointed criticism of Justice Jackson and her dissent.
Yeah, that got some media attention.
Yeah.
Suggested maybe that there was a bad personal blood between some of the justices. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I'm certain there have been cases where Justice Scalia was known for some pretty strong language, but typically that was when he was writing in dissents. In a majority opinion, to be so dismissive and almost contemptuous of a dissenting opinion was pretty striking and arresting. It's just not that common. It does suggest that there might be tension between Justice Jackson and maybe even the rest of the court. Her dissent didn't, neither Kagan nor Sotomayor joined it, for instance, which I think, given the circumstances, was interesting. But essentially, Justice Barrett said, she confessed that she doesn't want to focus on the legalese, which means she doesn't want to focus on the law, and her opinion shows that she doesn't understand the law, is essentially what Barrett said. So very, very strong language. So I just don't think that you have Justice Barrett, who doesn't come across as the kind of person who says that kind of thing very often. I don't think she says that unless there were maybe some simmering tension between Jackson and the rest of the court.
Mm. What about now that the term is concluded, looking forward to the next term, or even perhaps the suggestion that a long-serving justice like Justice Thomas might declare that he's stepping down from the court? Where do you see the court in personnel and in cases going forward?
Yeah, so they did have one case that they've held over from this term that's going to be a big one for next term. It's a case out of Louisiana involving redistricting and the creation of a majority-minority district. And the fact they've held it over for re-argument, if you look back at the history of cases that were held over for re-argument, there's some pretty big ones there. Brown versus Board of Education, for instance, cases kind of in that court category. I think that could be a pretty significant one for the next term. There was another case. I don't know that the issue will reach the court this next term, but they're going to have to consider it again. Case out of Oklahoma involving religious charter schools. And what happened there was that Oklahoma, in light of those cases I mentioned on Blaine amendments, they said that religious charter schools have to be allowed to operate if they apply, explicitly religious charter schools, by forbidding their participation in the charter school program, it would violate the free exercise clause. Oklahoma initially said that, then they had a change in the attorney general's office, and the new attorney general issued a different regulation involving it. So it reaches the Supreme Court. However, Justice Barrett recused herself. And so we ended up with a 4-4 tie. And so we don't know what the disposition of that will be. I suspect that if that issue reaches the Supreme Court again, and I think it will, Justice Barrett will vote in favor of religious charter schools. And so that could have significant impact on K-12 education policy. And then retirements. I think Thomas has 3 years until he's the longest serving justice or something like that. So there's this speculation. Thomas and Alito are the oldest. Of course, you have a Republican president and a Republican Senate. Sometimes justices will time their retirements so that someone that they hope will be more aligned with their judicial philosophy will be named their replacement. So it's possible, but there's also with Thomas, there's some thinking that, well, given that he seems pretty healthy and he could easily go another, 10, 15 years, given what we've seen with longevity on the court over the last 30 years or so. Maybe he won't retire, particularly since he could reach that milestone of being the longest serving justice on the Supreme Court.
Fascinating. Well, some very interesting issues to look forward to. Josh, it's always great to have you with us to discuss the cases. There's so many more we could discuss, but this has been a terrifically insightful conversation into some of the most important ones and what they mean for the court, for the law, and for us today. Josh Dunn, thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
It's great to be with you, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.